what Brooklyn sounds like.
Hey, it's time for Dr. Lisa Gives a Shit. I give a shit. How are you guys doing today? You know, I don't know. You know what? I'm going to Mexico City next week. I am so excited. And I'm going to some art fairs just for fun. Just for fun. I got a press pass so I can like sneak in. Are you listening, you people in Mexico? I'm going to just sneak in and maybe I'll report. Maybe I won't. I don't know. So next week we're going to, it'll be a surprise. I think I'm trying to get somebody to fill in. So it'll be great. It'll be a great show. And this is going to be a fucking amazing show because I have Eric Drysdale right here with me. And Eric is a writer, comedian, and 3D photography. We're going to talk about his extremely successful and his transition period in as a comedy writer. But before we do that, let's talk about Drive to Five, because this is really what's happening here. We have this amazing Drive to Five. It's a campaign, like a program. And if you go to radiofreebrooklyn.org/donate, like right now we have all this stuff going on and you can like donate money and get like one of our amazing t-shirts. Have you heard of Cosmo Vinyl? He used to be the manager for The Clash. So you get a t-shirt by him. I heard they're selling out. It's great. So go there and help us out because we need money. We need money in order to keep doing this. Okay. So hello, Eric.
Hi, Lisa.
You know, Dr. Lisa. I wanted to give you a little bit of a longer introduction so people really know who's here.
Okay.
Who's here in the studio.
I'll be over here.
So anyway, the thing is, guys, Eric is a really storied, or whatever you call it, a venerable and acclaimed TV writer and comedian. He's contributed, and Eric's like looking at me like, is she going to get this right? What is she going to say? This is all like, I'm not making this up. I found this on your site. Eric has contributed to over 1,500 hours of late night television as a staff writer for The Daily Show, Jon Stewart, The Colbert Report, The Late Show with Stephen Colbert, so he got rehired there, and Full Frontal with Samantha Bee. And there's all these like, it's this brief kind of resume thing starts around 2000 and goes to 2019, right? And most recently, you were on, you were writing for Samantha Bee, and yeah. You've decided to take a leave from there, and we will be discussing, right?
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, I'm really interested in hearing about that. Eric is also like really big in the stereo, what do you call it?
Stereo photography. 3D
photography, and he has almost a regular show at the City Reliquary, and you should go see it because it's really these stereo 3D things are awesome, and Eric gets amateur stuff, and it's all like, it's freaky, man. It's freaky, and it's entertaining, and it's a great thing for groups. Did you do a group with Oliver Sacks people? Did I see that?
A group of people from the Oliver Sacks Foundation. A friend of mine, Dempsey Rice, is producing a hybrid animated live-action documentary about Oliver Sacks, and some people from his foundation, including his archivist, are involved in it, and we did a fundraiser for them and did a couple of shows.
Oh, it's a fundraiser. Good idea. Did you hear that, Tom Tenney? There's a fundraising opportunity in here. Okay. So anyway, his next show there is at March 5th. You can go to cityreliquary.com. Look it up.
.org.
I'm not spelling it out, okay? And then, or you can go to edrysdale, drysdale.com. Okay, so, and I also wanted to say, in case you had any doubts on Eric's achievements, he's been nominated for 21 Emmys.
Oh, Jesus.
Oh, Jesus. Okay. And he had 10 wins.
Mm-hmm.
There.
And I deserve two.
Ah, so modest. Okay, so overall, how has your comedy writing career been? Is it exciting? We normal people or somewhat normal people think that it's just a pinch me. I can't believe this is happening every moment of every day. So tell us what it's like.
It's definitely a lot of that, but it's also an enormous, enormous amount of pressure and work.
Uh-huh. And what's it feel like?
If it weren't for that feeling like, I can't believe I get to do this, it wouldn't be worth it.
Mm-hmm. And so what is it really like? Like, there's pressure. So give us an example of how
that
feels.
You're under a very, very tight deadline. You sometimes have to do things on a tight deadline that wasn't your idea, or you don't think is the best idea for this particular piece. And you've just got to swallow everything and go and hit the keyboard. And, when you're done, something else will, the phone will ring and they'll need something else, and they'll need something else. And especially on the daily shows, like the Daily Show and the Colbert Report, it was absolutely, nonstop.
So do you get the feeling like, I'm projecting a lot here, countertransference. So I would be, if it was me, I would be like worrying that I wasn't good enough, or that this show was sucky, or that show. Do you think like that? Or is it just like you get so in the routine, you don't judge yourself every day?
I mean, I've been very fortunate. I was able to do that job for a long time. I did that job in various ways for almost 20 years. There's this saying that people have that it takes 2 years to learn a job. I felt like it maybe took me three or four till that panic. And it's never really gone, but where it was manageable. And I knew that if I failed one day, the next day I had a chance to do better. It took away a little while for that anxiety to go away.
Right. But you're not living with it you're like, I know this job. People look at you and they're like, well, Eric, he's going to get the job done.
And also you're
consistent.
And you're always up against a deadline. So you're only thinking about what's happening an hour from now when you have to turn this damn thing in, rather than the big picture, which is something that was both stressful about the job, but also that I really like about that kind of work.
So how long is an average assignment? Is it like a 4-hour assignment, or is it like
You know, on the Daily Show and the Colbert Report and even on the Late Show, the things like monologue jokes or things that go into a headline on one of the more newsy based shows. You'd have 3 or 4 hours to put it together after, a meeting that could last an hour or an hour and a half in the morning where you try to figure out what you're going to do.
So you never have a project that would be long, like a whole day.
No, you would. You would also be working on some pieces that would even have a shelf life of a couple days or even a couple weeks.
Oh. Yeah. Oh, okay.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. But all of your time is filled. Like you don't get a, like you have to be working on that stuff when you're not working on the stuff that's right for that day. There's always, especially in the Trump era, this was happening at Sam B all the time where, you'd be, we gave up on writing a show through the course of the week because on Wednesday morning, Trump would say something insane.
Oh, yeah,
and you'd have to rewrite the whole show.
Right. Oh, my God. So were there regular hours, or were there 12-hour days, or did it vary a lot, or were they all 12-hour days?
They were pretty long days, and they actually weren't that terrible. The show has to tape at a certain time, and by that time, all of the jokes for that show have to be in that show, and all the jokes for the next day's show we're going to worry about tomorrow. So it was actually really, or many of the jokes for the next day's show we would worry about. So there was a really nice thing about it that actually was more difficult about being on a weekly show was that you could just say, okay, that day's over. I failed. I did well. Whatever, tomorrow I get a whole new chance.
Mm-hmm. So you had regular hours, like what, 8?
Really
early?
Very much 9 to 5.
9 to 5.
9 to 6, 9 to 7 sometimes, 9 to 8 if you had to stay for taping or if there was a meeting afterwards. But you know, it wasn't this like SNL thing where you're there for 2 days and you'd never get to see the sun. And
I can't imagine.
Yeah.
You know, people have done that, right?
Oh, sure. Yeah.
Yeah, and that's hard.
Seems really like, hard.
Would you ever want to work on that show?
I would like to see what it's like.
Uh-huh.
But that passion is not there the way it was 20 years ago.
Right, right. I mean, it sounds like what you've had is like actually kind of preferable in certain ways.
In certain ways.
Yeah. And a weekly show, is that like where they make you work all night because they have, or like the night before the show airs, or what's that like?
It's about the same. It's, again, it got worse at Sam B once Trump became president and everything started becoming insane all the time. Everything got worse everywhere.
Look what his lawyers are going through now. They have to rewrite the whole strategy after they delivered it, right?
It's so crazy.
I know. But anyway, so I wanted to, politics. I wanted to ask you about politics.
Okay.
So what the fuck would it be like to be on staff at a place like that? Now, I'm as a female, I'm already like counter transferring. Like, I hate these guys. They're such douchebag guys.
Yeah.
But you being a, you know, you're a guy. And how were the politics? What was that like?
Do you mean like dealing with what was going
the
on?
The politics of the office, not the government. Like the internal politics, dealing with the other humans.
You know, with very few and far between exceptions, like, especially, like, again, like, there's no room for error in a show that's on every day that's filled with as many jokes as those shows. So there's no time for ego to get, like, I like this joke better, he never picks my jokes. Like, I mean, there's a little of that that goes around, but ultimately, it's like by the time you have time to worry about it, you have to be moving on to the next thing and working on something else.
So that sounds positive.
And for the most part, you know, again, putting on a show every day is really hard, and people work really hard, and all the staffs I've worked with have been amazing. And office politics, I guess it exists everywhere, but especially in the writers' area, we've got our heads down and
that's good to hear. You see people get fired a lot? See, this is my counter transference again. I'm neurotic. I'm like imagining this, you know. No,
it's
but do people, do writers, can you tell right away if they're going to work out? Do people not work out?
There are people that don't work out, and it's usually not like, oh my god, this person is terrible. It's like, oh, this person like maybe got lucky in their packet and hit the voice right, but they're probably like, there's never been anybody where I like was like, that's an unfunny person. Like,
right.
It's just the voice doesn't work. And usually it's mutual and the person knows that they're not a good fit. And
it's kind of a style thing.
Yeah.
And briefly, because I'm sure it's a long story, how did you get into the business? How did you wind up being a writer like that?
I mean, I always wanted to be a writer. So I came to New York and did stand up hoping that somebody would notice. And eventually, after 7 years of being here and on and off doing stand up, somebody noticed, and I was invited to submit a packet to the Daily Show.
Mm-hmm. And then you got on right away.
Yeah.
What was that day like?
I mean, it wasn't the first shot. It wasn't the first. I had applied to Conan several times. I had applied to other shows a bunch of times. It wasn't my first packet by any stretch. I've been doing it for years.
Yeah. So you were a directed person that liked late night TV since you were a kid, came to New York, followed your dream.
Yep.
And here we are now.
Here we are now.
And
at the end of my career.
Well, we're going to see about that. But when you got the job, when you got your first job, like what was that feeling like? What happened? That must have been incredible.
It was really, really scary and exciting. And
where was it? The Daily Show.
The Daily Show.
With Jon Stewart.
With Jon Stewart, yeah.
That's a big fucking deal.
Yeah, it was. It was a big fucking deal. It wasn't as big of a deal as it became later. You know, I was there. I was the second writer that was hired in the Jon Stewart era.
Oh, okay.
So he'd only been there for, I think, 9 months.
Mm-hmm.
And so he was still kind of like dealing with the remnants of the voice of Craig Kilborn's show trying to wrestle the staff into his vision of what the show was, which was a very interesting thing to be a part of.
Oh, yeah.
So it wasn't like joining The Daily Show. Like joining The Daily Show would have been, you know, but it was still exciting to have a comedy writing job in New York. It was very exciting, and I was a big fan of his stand up at the time, and actually didn't know much about the show itself. I just because I actually didn't even have a TV at that point. I got one so I could watch the show, this was the days before you could watch TV on the internet, so I had to actually get a TV to write my packet.
Oh, that's hilarious.
Yeah.
That's great.
Yeah, because I could get, I had my Conan packets that I had done before, but I could get that on my, like, over-the-air TV.
So you're...
I didn't have cable.
Right. So you were pretty directed about it. Like, you knew what you wanted to do. You went for it. You knew, you know, you found out everything. So this is, guys, this is what I want you to know about Eric, okay? And I was telling Eric this before he came on the show, is that I think Eric's a really good example for you guys, because as far as I can tell, he seems like a really, like, you know, a stable guy who, like, is methodical, hardworking, knows how to be professional, and not one of those wacky, out of control comedians that winds up on television, because that's never going to last if you really want to have a job, right? Am I right about that, Eric, to some degree?
Well, you're right about the second part. The first part is totally wrong. I'm a complete disaster.
Really?
Of a human being. Yeah, I mean...
What does that mean? Or what do you mean? What do you mean by that?
I mean, I really rely... I mean, one of the reasons that I feel like I was well-suited to these jobs is I really rely on the structure and panic of those things to whip me into shape, because otherwise I will sit around getting stoned all day.
Oh, okay.
yeah.
So you like outside structure...
Yes.
But you must be internally motivated on some level.
On some level.
Yeah, I think he's being a little modest. But here's the other thing, guys. You know what? Like, the fact that he's self-effacing about it is actually a real point in my book, because a lot of these people would just be like, you know, I'm, you know, of course I can do it no matter what, right?
Mm-hmm.
I'm stereotyping here. So Eric's a better example than the other kind.
I mean, there was a feeling that, like, I mean, not so much as a performer, like, I never felt super comfortable as a performer, but as a writer, when I was, you know, before I had gotten the Daily Show job and was out doing stand-up and characters and things like that, I was confident in the material.
Right.
Like, I never, that I had the confidence in mm-hmm. myself, in my ability to kind of wake up in the morning and be an adult and pay my bills and stuff like that. I had a lot less confidence in.
Mm-hmm. Do you now? Did you develop it? Maybe it was just youth.
I think that I have been heavily domesticated by
your wife.
20.
Is your wife, like, really, is she good at all that? What does she do again?
She's a public health researcher.
Oh, does she help create stability?
Oh, very much so.
But you like the stability? Or
I mean, I like it once I've achieved it, but it usually comes from external pressures.
Right. So you yourself may not be the pillar of stability, but you're attracted to being in situations
because I know what's good for me.
But you also feel comfortable if things around you are, I'm saying, like, stability appeals to you on some level.
I mean, I think that yes. Mm-hmm. I like being told what to do on mm-hmm. a day-to-day basis. Being in this place where I'm, like, I'm kind of writing for myself or writing to pitch something, it's a much more difficult situation. Like, do whatever you want. Like, I can't, it's a much harder assignment than do this thing for me.
I'm sure it is. So let's get to where you are now. Let's start getting there. So your last full-time job mm-hmm. was Samantha Bee, right?
Yep.
So how was that? And what? How long were you there? And how did you left?
Yeah.
You decided I'm done here.
And well, I decided that I was done doing political comedy in the age of Trump, and I mm-hmm. happened to be at Samantha Bee at the time, mm-hmm. which was a great place to be for it.
Yeah.
You know, it was kind of as horrible as the situation is, you know, I felt like she was in a unique place to say something about it, and I was really happy to be a part
yeah.
of it. I just, and actually I actually had left, I left, the Colbert Report actually, in 2007 because I was looking ahead at the 2008 election and thought that that was going to get really ugly.
Mm-hmm.
And I had hoped that I would go off and, you know, write a sitcom or do something else. The writer's strike happened, so that never happened. And I ended up going back to the Colbert Report 2 years later. But, yeah, I mean, I really do, like, part of the reason that I think I'm good at that job mm-hmm. is that I am an angry, sensitive person. And, when I get angry and sensitive, I get funny. And, but it's also not a great place to be all the time is to be angry and sensitive. Yeah, it was always this balancing act, and I left in 2007 to protect my mental health, and that's sort of what I did this time.
Mm-hmm. And what did you do, like, in 2007? Did you go back, like, a year later when the election was over? Or is
2 years later.
So you took 2 years off then?
Yeah.
And how was that? Did you get job offers? Like,
was it really by choice?
It was really by choice.
It was really by choice. I did do some small jobs mm-hmm. and then the writer's strike happened mm-hmm. Which took us mm-hmm. and then it kind of took a long time for mm-hmm. production to get back into gear, so I was sort of at the end of mm-hmm. You know, my savings and had to go back and do something. So luckily mm-hmm. There were some other transitions going on at the Rapport, and it was a good time for me to be back, and I'm really glad I came back because mm-hmm. those last few years at the show were amazing.
I can only imagine.
The first, like, I think, like, within 2 weeks that I was back, I wrote something for Philip Glass.
Wow, really?
Yeah.
Like, wow.
That's the great thing about that show is, like...
You mean like a sketch? Or
yeah, a sketch. And, like, I wrote stuff and he played music and...
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow. Okay, so you've done this before, you know, and that's a very self-protective skill or way of identifying that. That's very impressive. See, I'm telling you guys, he's a good example. He was in touch with what was going to make him crazy, and then he opted how to cope with it, and it was very productive.
Yeah,
good job.
And I am grateful that I don't have to go and make what is happening today while we're talking here funny.
Right, like, and he also didn't have you don't have any kids.
No.
See, that's another thing, guys. Remember that.
If you have kids, get rid of them.
Okay, so Samantha Bee, you were there for
3 years.
3 years, and then, like, what? How did you decide to leave? Like, what happened?
I happened to be at the end of a cycle of contracts with them, and saw that this election was coming in, getting nasty, and I was not. I was finding it harder and harder to kind of come in and face the Trumpiness of it all every day. Mm-hmm. So it was just time.
Were you getting depressed?
Oh yeah.
And what's depression like for you? I mean, is it like you sit around, or is it an anxiety kind? Is it an angry kind?
It's a sitting around kind.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And you're like, you know, you're depressed.
Oh yeah. Yeah.
And a lot
of bedtime.
Mm-hmm. And do you also know that if you leave the job that it's going to help you? Do you know that?
I think I knew that, yes.
So it's circumstantial, which is the best kind of depression, folks. It's that chemical stuff that's so hard.
Well, there's a little of that too.
Well, yeah, probably.
Yeah.
I mean, you are a comedian writer. You got to have some of that.
Yeah.
So did it work when you left? I mean, are you feeling better?
I'm feeling better in some ways. Again, I'm grateful for that. Uh-huh. I am, you know, one of the things I did get used to at those jobs was, like, a very high level of activity, both physical and mental.
Right.
And that's been a difficult hole to fill.
There's a lot of alone time with Eric Drysdale, isn't
there? Yeah, it's a little too much alone time.
Yeah. When you left, was that, did everybody go like, oh my God, how can you leave? Were they
no,
shocked?
They understood.
Yeah. They were like, oh God, yeah, Eric, you're going to like, don't off yourself, right? No, so they knew.
Yeah, they knew. No, I had even had some discussions with them. Like, I'm just not doing it. They knew that I wasn't doing well, and I knew that I wasn't doing well, and it wasn't good for anybody.
See, that's a healthy relationship at work where you can actually have that kind of, Eric, put the cup in the cup holder. I will get yelled at. Not you, at me.
Okay.
So anyway, you know, that's a healthy relationship with a work situation where you can sort of like check in with them and there's communication. Very rare. Very, very rare, I think.
Yeah. I mean, I also have a terrible poker face. I'm not if something's bothering me, you're going to be able to tell.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Mm-hmm. Was it like literally like the Trump experience that got to you?
Or? Yeah, very much so.
So it was really that. And so you're facing that again.
Am I?
Well, I mean that's
I'm facing
why
it the same way everybody else is.
No, but you were facing it. Oh, the first time he got elected? No, wait. The last time you quit.
Was before the Obama-McCain.
Oh, okay. So, yeah.
Race.
Right. So this is different.
Yeah.
Similar, but somewhat.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So,
and also when I did leave in 2007, I feel like my relationship to the work changed. Like, I think that wanting to be a comedy writer all my life and then finally being that and being it at a show that had all of this, acclaim and the Emmys and, you know, I think that I wrapped a lot of my identity up in the show that first time around.
Yeah.
And I feel like when I came back in 2009, I viewed it more as work.
Oh, you were able to separate you, your ego, your self-image from the job.
Right. And that comes and goes. Like sometimes I forget that I'm not just that.
Right.
It's something that definitely I learned over that break.
And I think any writer in your position struggles with that, no?
Yeah, I think so.
I mean, how can you not? I just want to remind people that they're listening to Radio Free Brooklyn, the greatest station in the Western Hemisphere. I know because I've checked. And why don't you, you can have Radio Free Brooklyn with you all the time. Just go to radiofreebrooklyn.org and download a app for iPhone or Android or whatever. So it's Dr. Lisa. I'm here with Eric Drysdale, a long time late night talk show writer. Anyway, we're talking about his career transition, I guess, or whatever we're talking about. So, okay. So now what? Now what? Now what's life like now? Like what kinds of things have come up for you and what are you thinking about for your future and stuff like that? Like, how is it?
So I can't say that I've been trying really hard yet.
How long has it been?
It's been almost exactly a year.
Oh.
I have had a couple of small jobs. The best one, I think I did a pilot with Asif Manvi, also from The Daily Show.
Mm-hmm.
We did a travel show, and I don't think it went at Apple TV, which was really great. But other than that, there has just little bits here and there.
Mm-hmm.
And I am working on some writing, but I'm feeling a lot of pressure about it. Like it's not easy to do. Like,
right. But what like, kind of things?
Like sitcom writing or feature writing stuff that I have absolutely no experience in. I'm not known for. So it's daunting.
Is that something that you'd like to like? If you had a wish list, would that be it?
No, because I know that I have done what I can do in the field that I've done. So I'm trying to figure out what's next.
Mm-hmm.
And I have a little time. I have a little time and it's been interesting.
You have. So what's been interesting? Like what's going on? What's going on?
Uh, I mean, I have written some things. Things that I do not enjoy reading or writing so far. But I feel like just doing the writing is going to get me to the place where eventually I will.
So
trying to give myself that structure and you got to get this done kind of feeling that I would get at work, but outside of it.
Huh. Interesting. Which is
hard to do.
You're trying to create stability for yourself from within, which is kind of cool.
Yeah.
And what?
With moderate success.
Well,
so far.
You have your eye on it. You're aware of it.
Yeah.
That's something. So it sounds also like you're focusing on your, your talent and the satisfaction you get from it as a writer right now. Is that what you're focused on developing your writing? Is that what I'm hearing?
In my career, yes.
In your career, as it relates to your career.
Yes.
What do you mean by that?
Well, I mean, the first thing that I did when I left Sambia was I just played with photography for, a few months.
Mm-hmm.
I took photos. I played with my collection, got it, did some writing about it. Things that involve using my hands and not my brain so much.
Right. Different muscles.
Yeah.
So you took a break.
I did take a break.
And then did you miss writing eventually?
No, I still don't, which is.
Writing a job or is writing a vocation? What is it to you, do you think?
I think for me, it's a job. I feel like every writer who calls themselves a writer must feel this, but it seems like everybody else is better at it than far in terms of like just sitting down and writing stuff.
You really think so?
I mean, any writer would tell you that it's torture.
Yes. Yeah. Yes.
So I'm experiencing that. It's torturous.
Do you see yourself as a lazy person?
No.
Okay.
No, I definitely don't. I just get enthusiastic about things that about things that will not pay my bills.
Huh. And what about pursuing those things?
I got to pay my bills.
You got to pay your bills. You have to have a job. You really need a job.
Yeah, and I also need this. Yeah, I need all of the stability that the job affords.
And the structure and
all that. And the money is part of that.
Yeah, of course. And the health insurance and all that.
Yeah.
See, that's why I'm saying he's a really good example, guys. Get a stable job. Get health care. I'd say this to all the kids. Well, don't just fucking think you're going to be an artist of some bullshit source. Get a job. Get stability. Learn how to make a living before you do everything else.
Right? Yeah. I mean, that's really what happened when I moved to the city is, I moved to the city in 1993. Moved in with a couple of friends from college. Smoked pot all the time. Mm. Eventually, I got evicted from my apartment because I was using the money that people were giving me for the rent to buy more pot.
Wow.
And it took 4 years for me to just learn how to live like an adult and get a job. I worked at Kaplan Test Prep for a while. Mm-hmm. I worked at a couple of graphic design firms after that. Mm-hmm. But I had to learn how to be an adult before I could.
So would you say that you were a pot addict? Did you go to any pot?
No.
Pot things?
No. I mean, I would.
Was it?
I a pot addict? I don't know. I've been a habitual smoker since I was 14 or 15 years old.
No, we're not. I mean, pot addict in the sense of the pot getting in the way of your life.
Oh, definitely at that time.
I'm not talking about.
Definitely at that time, yes.
So, you had to learn how to organize your life?
Yeah.
But it wasn't really just that you had to be high all the time.
I preferred to be.
Do you get stoned at work? I mean, work when, see, so that's what we're, that's.
Not at work.
Yeah, so you can't do your job when you're stoned or you wouldn't do your job when you're stoned.
I wouldn't.
Yeah. So, okay. So, see, more adult there. You're a little more adult than you think, I think.
Okay.
Did your parents see you as an adult? Or, see you as a responsible kid, let's put it that way.
No.
What did they see you as?
Well, I mean, because I was always kind of a screw up. Like, even like in school, like I had discipline problems, probably like ADHD before they had a name for it.
Mm-hmm.
No, I was a total spaz. Are you allowed to say spaz?
Fuck yeah.
Okay.
You know, somebody once gave some, and you know the show, but some, I'm not going to mention names, but you know who it is, gave somebody a blowjob on the station. So whenever, so you can do whatever you want okay. here. Were you not a good student? Did you get bad grades?
I got bad grades.
People didn't think you were smart?
I just wasn't interested.
And you didn't feel any fear of authority or failure? You didn't care?
I didn't feel great about it, but I just had my mind on other things. Like, I was into, like, listening to music and comedy, and it just wasn't at the top of my priorities.
So if you were interested...
And, like, mm-hmm. being bad at, like, math and not caring about it, like, math class, and
mm-hmm.
it didn't, like, it made me feel bad while I was in math class, but I did not give a shit once mm-hmm. I left.
And how did your family treat you in that way? Were they like, you know, Eric, you're great no matter what? Or were they like, when are you going to get improve your grades?
There were meetings. It was not. I think that deep down they understood that I was not going to be, you know,
a failure.
I was going to say, like, I was not going to go and be a lawyer or a doctor or something like that. Which I don't think they ever had any expectation mm-hmm. like that. They were both. I still think that they were concerned.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So I'm wondering if some of that still, like, that vision of yourself is still a little bit in there.
The vision of myself as?
Somebody who doesn't have their shit together, basically.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Very much so.
But the world has proven you wrong about that.
Well, the world has provided conditions where I can fake it.
Ah, interesting. Hmm. Okay, so
Or conditions where I can overcome my limitations.
Right, which you have developed coping skills.
Yes.
So what do you think, where's the growth now? Like, what do you think is going on? Like, how is your perspective on life changing through having this whole all this time off in a kind of an open future and stuff like that? Like, what can we learn?
I actually don't have a lot of answers yet. Uh-huh. I know that I'm at a crossroads to some degree, and I know that I don't want to go backwards, but I'm not sure what forward looks like
mm-hmm.
yet.
Mm-hmm. Have you had success in any way or any kind of, and when I say success, a lot of times what I really mean is just achieve something that gives you personal satisfaction. Mm-hmm. Have you had any of those in particular in the, you know, the time that you've been?
Yes.
And
yeah.
And like, where would those be?
I mean, that was like working on an Asif show. That was really rewarding. Got to go to South Africa for that.
Wow.
I even said, like, because I sort of got used to this idea that I'm not a good person to have in the field, you know, uh-huh. on a field shoot.
Right.
And I sort of got that into my head, but, you know, it was part of the job. So I went and I did it and it was fine. And so.
Oh, wow.
So, you know, I found a new thing that I could probably do.
That you enjoyed?
That I might enjoy eventually.
Uh-huh. Oh, that's good. You got out of your comfort zone.
I did.
That's a big deal, I think,
I
right?
Think so.
Going
yeah.
to shoot in South Africa? How long yeah. were you there?
Not long enough, like 5 days, maybe,
but
six.
Yeah, it's a lot of pressure and a lot of dealing with people. And mm-hmm. yeah, that's a big deal. Good for you.
Yeah.
And anything else? Did that project come to you or did
it
you?
It came to me, yeah.
Yeah, okay. So, anything else like that you particular?
I'm sorry, what was the question again? That made me feel.
Okay. So, we were talking about things that you have gotten satisfaction out of or, you know, that,
I mean,
that
there, you've had there's some the, growth. There's like the side hustle of the 3D shows mm-hmm. where I, I share my collection of 3D slides with people in these salons mm-hmm. that you're talking about earlier. And that's fine. It's really nice. And I really do get a lot out of it. But again, it's hard not to let it suck up so much time that and energy that, because I am not going to be able to make a living at it.
You're not going to be that guy.
Well, I'm not going to be that guy. I mean, yes. I mean, I bet you somebody with the right mix of things could make a living doing that. Uh-huh. But I don't want to spend my time doing the things mm-hmm. that I would have to do to make mm-hmm. a living at that.
Have you pursued any career options? Like, I'm wondering, this is what I'm thinking about. I'm thinking about, this is what I'm wondering about anyway. So I'm picturing you figuring out projects for yourself that are career oriented, like, you know, those writing projects. And then you got offered a few little, well, that's a big job, some jobs and stuff like that. But like, I'm wondering if you're like thinking about pursuing like a career option that isn't coming to you or that you haven't really thought about, a new idea. Something different.
Oh, I would love that. It just hasn't come to me yet.
It hasn't. Is that what you're looking for, though?
No, I'm not necessarily looking for that, but I'm open to it. I'm open to it. I feel like it's as likely to happen that way as to go back
And is that what you're giving yourself time for now?
Yeah.
To do that?
Yeah.
So what have you gotten out of your writing projects?
Not a lot yet. I mean, a lot of, it's funny because I have a lot of fear about it. I have a lot of fear about writing and, you know, you gave this like long thing about my bona fides, and I go into an office with that and, you know, there are expectations for a script coming from a guy with that resume, and it's a lot of pressure.
Yeah, because in a certain way, you're a beginner, right?
If you haven't done
it professionally. But then they also think, well, if he does, yeah.
Yeah. So it's
harder because you're successful in a way.
I'm not going to be poor me. I'm successful. But
no, emotionally. We don't care about that.
It's just, yes, it is. It's a lot of self-doubt.
Uh-huh.
Am I as good as I am at this other thing as I am at the other thing?
Or can you get as
good? Or can I get as good? And can I get as good in enough time, you know, to not be poor?
Right. So have you sent your work to anybody or showed it to anybody? Have you gotten feedback?
I have gotten some feedback.
Uh-huh. And how's that gone?
Pretty good. Pretty good. Yeah. I mean, it's bad in that I'm not as far along as I would like to be, but it's good in that it confirmed that I'm where I thought I was,
mm-hmm.
if that makes sense.
Where is that? I mean,
I'm learning.
So you're having growth.
Yes.
In your writing.
I think so. Slow, but yes.
Oh, well, that's cool.
Yes.
There you go. So you think maybe a movie or a scripted show then?
Yeah.
I could see that.
Yeah.
I could see that. And do you know people in those fields?
Sure.
So when you're
ready. Yeah,
and I've
gotten good advice and had long conversations and people have read things and I'm heading in the right direction. It's mm-hmm. just, again, no structure, mm-hmm. there's no hard deadline on anything. Mm-hmm. Lot of time to second guess myself. Mm-hmm. Things like that.
It's just a lot of time alone.
Yeah. And also, missing that room full of the funniest people in the world.
Which, right.
You know,
right.
It's really nice to have.
Right. That's going to be hard. Yeah. So the other thing is that's interesting is like when you work on a show with, you know, like a, you know, brand name, it's somebody's show and it's you can be pretty invisible.
Yes. Which I like.
And you like that. But in order to get to the next level.
It's not as much as being invisible that I like. It's about being somebody else.
Mm-hmm. What does that mean? Mm-hmm.
Because I have a better idea of. I have a better. Yeah.
You mean you have a better idea
of what Stephen Colbert's voice sounds like than what mine would sound like. Just because I didn't take the time and be a stand-up for 8 years and figure out what my voice was.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I am a hired hand. I'm somebody mm-hmm. who will write jokes in your voice.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So now you really, so this is kind of what maybe you're developing is your own voice?
Yeah. Which is, you know, it's a little late.
Do you really feel like that?
No, not really. I mean, and it's always been there, you know.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I was always doing my own thing on the side, you know.
Like writing and
Performing. making short films and things like
that. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Wow. It sounds pretty good. And what about the stability thing? Like, do you have a certain amount of time that you write, or is that still like, how's your days go?
I do try. I actually got a subscription to a workspace, and I do try to go in 3 times a week and write for a few hours straight, no matter what.
Oh, that's good.
Which is torturous, but I do it.
Why is writing always torturous?
I feel like it might be, yes.
Because
again, it's been a long time since I've been doing it outside of these very pressurized and standardized and structured ways of doing it. But yeah, just sitting there and writing is no fun.
Writing alone, I mean, I guess.
Or I haven't stumbled upon that idea or thing that makes the gears click and propels me to keep going and make it better and better and better. I'm still sort of like flailing around, finding different things. And there are like definitely big chunks of stuff that I've written that I feel like, oh, that's good. I've learned something here about how to structure a scene or how to structure a story. Everything has yet to come together.
Mm-hmm. And where are you getting your inspiration? Are you going to see a lot of stuff? Is there a kind of thing that you like, or what kind of stuff do you write about?
I started just writing scenes between people that I imagined, like without like ideas about what the whole thing was about, just because I have very little experience doing that. And I felt like it would be a good way to kind of dip myself in to fiction writing, kind of like almost like improv scenes.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I started with that.
Mm-hmm. Humans.
Just human interaction, which really joke writing isn't. I mean, it's about power structures and it's about status in some ways, but a conversation between two people is much, much more complicated.
Uh-huh. How do you see that?
Especially like between two people who are, you know, in a scene driving a story, like. Everything that they have to say to each other has to be revealing of their character and move the story forward. And it's something that people who do it professionally do with a lot of transparency, and you don't see the strings. And
right.
You know, it's a different muscle. And
wow.
Yeah, I've been working on my lats. I got to start working on my quads. I don't know what those things are. I just talked as if I knew what the human body was, and I have no idea. Are the lats and quads related?
So did you feel like that was stuff that you kind of left out when you were working on the talk shows? On the night, whatever?
What do you mean?
Late night. Like, in other words, like when you're working on a late night show, you're mm-hmm. writing jokes and stuff like that, but you're not writing scenes as much. And did you ever, were you feeling like that was something?
I mean, there is a sense to which even Jon Stewart was a character.
Mm-hmm.
Colbert on the Colbert Report was definitely a character.
Mm-hmm.
And there were scenes,
mm-hmm.
but not in the same way that you have to write a scene to actually move a story along.
Mm-hmm. Where it's coming from you.
Right.
Yeah. Is some of that hard to like.
Yeah. I mean, one thing I've kind of dipped my toe in this a bunch of times over the last, you know, since I started doing this. And it's one of the things I realized is that I don't like bad things to happen to my characters, which is completely the whole point of drama is that bad things happen to your characters. But it's like, I like this guy. I don't want anything to happen to him.
You're protective of your
characters. Yeah, so that's no fun. That's no fun to watch.
Wow. So what else have you gone to travel, or where do you are you getting your inspiration? Are you going to see more? Are you exposing yourself to more stuff?
Well, I always I'm at museums all the time.
Mm-hmm.
I've been playing competitive pinball, which has been really interesting.
That's crazy, really?
Yeah.
What is that? I don't even. I didn't know
that. It's exactly what it sounds like.
And is there like teams or?
There's so much. There's like teams. There are leagues. There are like teams for there are leagues for individual players. There are leagues for teams. There are leagues for women.
Wow!
Yeah.
And you guys compete?
Yeah.
Wow! How? What is that, like a weekly?
I do it weekly. Yeah.
Are you really? You must be good at it.
I'm getting better. I'm usually like somewhere in the middle. Like I've been doing it for four months or so.
Uh huh.
And yeah.
So there's a group of people that you're involved with.
Yeah, a little bit.
There's structure there.
Yeah.
That's so funny.
Yeah.
Wow. How do you, like, you can get, like, that is such a weird thing. Did you can, play that as?
Absolutely. Well, it's something that was always part of my life. I always loved it when I was a kid. The place where my dad worked had a machine, and I was there all the time playing it. And kind of at the height of my interest in that machine, I went to Sid and Marty Krofft World, which was a Atlanta theme park that was only there for 6 months, and they had a ride where you could ride in a pinball machine.
What?
Yeah.
And were the pinballs like?
They weren't free floating. They were like on a track, but
were they human size? Or
yeah,
like
yeah. You get into a pinball, and then fly.
You are the pinball.
You're in the pinball.
Wow.
So and that made a big impression. But then in high school, I was a player, and then in college, I always found the machines. I always found it easier than. Mm-hmm. I always found it more rewarding than a video game, just mm-hmm. because I could last longer playing mm-hmm. it, and I found like the rule sets and all of the skill stuff interesting. And so I had a little time and I figured, you know, this is something I've always been interested in. Let's see if I can get any better at it if I play competitively. And I think I have gotten a little better.
There, that and seemed been, more goal oriented.
And it's been interesting to be around people who do it competitively, because it's like really, there's a lot to it.
And do they really focus on, I mean, strategy and
yep.
practice and
yep.
thumbnail size?
Mm-hmm.
Wow. So that's interesting. That's an interesting part of humanity.
Yes.
You know what I always missed? I was thinking about, you know, when you start talking about being around people, what something I miss about relationships in offices, which you can't, which is really hard to have anywhere else, is that just being around people and sort of joking around, or just being around people where you're all paid to be there and it's all a job to be there. And there's no like sometimes like I feel like, I want to make plans with that person. I got to get in touch with them. They probably won't. And then when I get together with them, I hope they're having a good time. I hope I'm not boring them. And what are we going to do?
You can have these lower pressure relationships with people.
Yeah. Yeah. Incidental or circumstantial relationships.
Yeah.
And you, right?
Yeah. So there's something nice about that.
There's something really comforting about, or just easy. Like, do you have to find more ways to see people? Are you putting more
energy? Yeah, I have to make effort.
And how is that?
It's nice. Yeah, yeah. It's really good. I mean, yeah. Try to have lunch with somebody every couple of days, you know.
That's great. And do you keep, so you must know so many people from work. Do you still,
yeah,
you
I still
go, do you get invited? You still go to the, you still go to the parties, or they still invite
no.
you to stuff? Or what's your feeling about it? Just time to move
there's
on.
Not, you don't really get invited in that way to a party.
Those it's shows, really yeah, a yeah. work thing.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Wow. Okay, we've got 5 minutes left, and let's see if there's something you said that your dog is a real pain in the ass. So let's. I just want to hear about that. Let's fit
that
in
there.
She's
a rescue. She's about a year and a half old. She's just very super reactive on the street. Like she's just super vigilant and barks at anything that moves. She hasn't done anything terrible yet, but the vet basically told us if we don't deal with these issues soon, she will bite somebody or bite a kid. that she's like super reactive towards kids. But between some, we have her on meds and have done some training with her and have seen a bit of an improvement.
You have her on meds?
Yeah.
Antidepressants?
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
What, how does, has it made a change? Can you tell?
Very much so, yeah.
In what way? Less anxious?
Yeah.
Wow, just like with people.
Just like with people.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's crazy.
Yeah, it just kind of got her to a place, it got to a kind of a quieter mindset where the stuff we were doing with the trainer could actually sink in.
Interesting. Is that a lifelong thing that dogs are going to be on? Is she going to be on that forever?
I don't know.
Have you talked to, so she's kind of like in therapy.
She really is.
Yeah.
She really is. She's got some issues and she's dealing with them and she's in therapy and kind of doing some, I guess it's kind of related to CBT, cognitive behavioral therapy, where she's kind of doing these exercises where she's trying to control her impulses and things like that.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Wow. Wow.
Well, she's not doing them alone. We're doing them with her.
Right. She's not motivated.
Yeah.
She doesn't get it.
Yeah. We can't hand her a book and.
No, and it's all about
tell her getting, to do a workbook.
It's all about getting along with humans, isn't it?
Yes.
It's about her socializing her
and with dogs.
Conforming. Really? Is she really aggressive with dogs?
She can be and has been, but that's also getting a little better.
Is she annoying?
She is right now.
And what's that like? Like, is she always demanding?
Yeah, or, yeah.
Yeah. So you want to chill her out.
You want to chill her out?
Have you bought her beer?
There's dog beer?
No.
Oh. Just regular
Why do you
human
need beer?
Beer.
Yeah. My husband feeds our dog beer.
To mellow her out?
No, just like if we go, we take her to a bar. And
I don't drink, so.
Oh, well.
There's beer. Very rarely alcohol in the house.
Well, you know, maybe that's what it is.
Did we have to get our dog drunk?
Maybe she needs a cocktail hour. So you got her as a puppy?
Yep.
And she was already damaged?
She was beautiful. She was wonderful the first several months, but kind of backslid.
And do they think that's from her childhood?
They do.
Well, how old was she? I mean, how could that be? That's crazy.
Yeah, it doesn't seem. I mean, she was only 16 weeks old when we got her.
Yeah.
But also, we didn't do anything to her since then that would make her like that. So.
I think it sounds, I'm just going to tell you, in my opinion, that sounds a little like a racket.
Really? What, the therapy part?
Yeah, I don't know.
Except for the fact that it's actually worked.
Oh, right. Well, then it doesn't really matter.
Yeah.
I think they're putting parental guilt on you. You got the dog after 16 weeks and you think that the problems are from its childhood. I'm not sure if I buy that. I'm just saying, I'm not sure if I buy that.
Yeah, I buy it.
Really?
Yeah, I do.
Why? I don't get it. Was she crazy when you got her?
She was crazy in some ways.
You can see it.
But the aggressiveness came a little later.
Yeah, when she felt comfortable.
Yeah.
Okay, well, anyway, Eric, thank you. You know, we're going to have you on again in like in another 6-8 months.
I feel like I've bared my soul and said it all.
Oh, well, you know, when you have, you know, done another, you know, 6 months, a year of writing, and then we can check in and be inspired by your, you know, we'll be hearing about your, you know, movie that's about to come out or God knows.
Sounds good.
What?
Yeah.
So stick around and.
Thank you, Lisa.
Thank you. And stick around. And we've got great programming this afternoon. Lost and Rewound with Elon Danziger right after this. So.